Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, good morning once again. This is Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. And part two of our show, May 18, 2020. Good to be here. David Wolf will join us tomorrow, 9 o'clock Central. So after the show, get your questions in for David Wolf, probably one of the foremost health gurus on in the vegetarian vegan world, David Wolf. He'll be here tomorrow. A couple great shows for you on Wednesday that I think you're going to find fascinating. Two very unique people talking about some of the legality of the people that are pushing this corona thing, and actually some ways you may be able to protect yourself if you feel so inclined. And then also going back to some really old medicine and how some of the modern medicine came into being even before the early 1900s with the Rockefeller Foundation thing. Pretty fascinating stuff that I read an article and invited the man on, and he said, yep, yeah, and that'll happen on Wednesday. Here's our contact info if you have a question or a comment for our next guest. He's here on the second Monday at 10:30 Central, Ray Peet. Very well respected around the world. PhD, University of Oregon, specialization in physiology. He started working on hormones back in 68, wrote his dissertation in 72. He outlined the ideas on progesterone and hormones closely related to it. His main thesis is that energy and structure are interdependent and at every level. We love that. His website is raypeet.com, and we'll tell you how to get his newsletter. And he's here, and we love talking to him because he's been around a while. And so it's always fun to have somebody who has done a lot of research. Dr. Peet, good morning.
Good morning.
How are things up there where you are, sir?
Oh, it's been rainy for several days, but a pretty warm spring, so Everything is growing.
Dr. Ray Peet, do you think it's possible if we have cold weather blowing through, rain or chill or stress, that we can create a situation where we think we have caught the flu or the, created a cold from a virus, but it was really an internal combustion from things like, weather changes and stress and things?
Oh, for sure. Change in atmospheric pressure causes all sorts of symptoms. Usually it's increasing pressure that brings on the worst symptoms. The rising oxygen tension actually is harmful when the pressure is increasing with cold air. Cold, dry air is very heavy, and so it increases the atmospheric pressure.
Interesting.
Cold weather also, when you stay inside and run a heater, that raises the dryness increases, the relative humidity decreases when you raise the temperature, and so if you have a cold wave of dry air coming in, and then you heat your house, you make super dry air with a high oxygen tension, and that causes lung injury, and so your lungs are really susceptible to anything, bacteria or fungus or virus, but simply any stress can make those irritated lung surfaces produce symptoms. Normally, your lungs are the main detoxifying organ for things like circulating serotonin. If your intestine is irritated because you ate some strange food, they secrete serotonin into the blood, and it's carried to the lungs to be detoxified. But if anything is happening in your lungs, even inflammation just from the dry air, extra oxygen pressure, then if your lungs fail to detoxify it, then you get all of these serotonin symptoms, which can include increased coagulation in your blood. For example, it's known that lung disease, colds, influenza, anything that messes up your lungs increases the risk of systemic coagulation and strokes, even in young people. Some of the news stories in recent weeks have said that there is this horrible new quality of coronavirus.
Yes.
Young people are having strokes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not at all new. Colds, severe cold, increases the risk of a stroke.
So do I hear you saying, though, that we can produce symptoms, fevers, all kinds of things with the lungs because of outside influences that are not necessarily a virus or a bacteria that has come in from the outside and entered our being?
Right. Just emotional stress.
And then, so the body is producing these symptoms, why? To detox or to heal?
That's the basic mechanism, that when the body experiences a threat, it turns on the adrenal system, for example, the Hanseli adaptive reaction system. He explained that the high cortisol lets you have super adaptive properties for a while, but then if it continues too long, that high cortisol melts down your immune system. Your thymus shrinks in a matter of hours of high cortisol. And so even emotional stress that keeps your cortisol elevated for a while, it is melting away your immune system. A young person with a big, juicy thymus gland, if they have a severe accident and live for maybe 4 or 5 hours, it's found that their thymus is gone.
Interesting. So it's possible then that there could be many people, thousands, millions, whatever, that are experiencing flu-like symptoms that they think they've caught a virus, that just because of the fear that's instilled to them through the media have creating symptoms. It's possible without coming in contact with any virus.
Not just possible, it's known.
Known, not just possible. It's known.
Yeah.
And then if you would give a test to one of these persons, either before or after, and it showed positive, does that mean anything?
Yeah, that they're immune to that, supposedly. If you have antibodies to something, it means you've adapted to it successfully. Same with blood tests for classes of antibodies. They find that you have antibodies to potatoes or blueberries or whatever in your blood, and they say never eat potatoes or blueberries because you have antibodies to them. But actually, it means you've adapted to them. It's okay to eat them.
So these PCR antibody tests that they give to just regular people, that they want to test everybody, and this is the meme, let's test everybody, are they of any value whatsoever?
Somewhat. It will tell you that something like 80 or 90% of the people that might have the actual virus sitting on some membrane isn't going to get sick. It shows you that the virus is harmless for the great majority of people.
So the people testing positive, you're saying, could possibly be they have an antibody to, but not necessarily the COVID virus,
The PCR test is to find the actual virus, which can be present in most people without causing either symptoms or antibodies, but possibly the antibodies will develop. But then the other tests are looking for antibodies, and some of the tests that have been used have not been able to discriminate between any old standard coronavirus and the new coronavirus.
Yes, sir. Dr. Ray Pete. But so in mid-February, when this thing kind of blew up, and all of a sudden they had this test, let's test people. There wasn't enough tests, but we're going to get more tests. There wasn't enough tests, and people were testing positive. How would it be possible, logically, or from a virology standpoint, that you could have a test that quickly that would be accurate to testing some virus, a new virus named Corona, that hasn't been around until now?
To know the meaning of a test, you have to test the test. And they didn't do that. It takes a long time to know whether a test is going to tell you anything. And so the test results, whether they're antibodies or PCR for the actual virus, you have to first establish what it means. They're just like a bunch of crazy chickens talking about numbers without having tested what the numbers mean.
And how long generally, Dr. P, would it take to have one of these test trials to make it really very accurate? And what would be very accurate? 70% accuracy? 80%?
You have to test lots of healthy people and some sick people too. And then compare the differences, see if there's more antibody or more virus in the sick people than in the healthy people, and develop the meaning of the test on the basis of actual results, conditions in the real world. But if you only test sick people and say a certain percentage have the virus, or only test healthy people, if you concentrate on the population in general, like the study in Northern California, Jay Bhattacharyan and his group were showing that the number of infected people was low, and also the mortality per infection was very low, but still they didn't test a big enough population to be certain of how many really are infected in that given area. But he said he was getting emails from colleagues saying things like, "Jay, get with the program." And program means the conforming to the opinion, mm-hmm. the authoritative opinion.
Yes, sir.
Don't investigate and stir things up.
And if you really wanted to do, according to virology, a test in general, how long can you theorize or the record show, how long of a time frame would it take before that test was, we have a good one here, we have something real that's valuable? How long?
I would guess at least 6 months.
6 months.
But meanwhile, the conditions are changing. And so you, in principle, it's very hard to do anything scientifically meaningful when you have a virus that changes radically in 3 or 4 or 5 months.
And this virus... So you're saying there is a virus that is outside the body for some people, and there's also many that are just creating symptoms from their own viral load or from their own microbiome. How would you say it?
If you don't distinguish very precisely to know that it's a certain mutant coronavirus. Everyone is exposed to many different kinds of coronaviruses. And so when you're under stress, your body might multiply and respond to some of the coronaviruses that are around you all the time, or other viruses or bacteria, or you might even have similar reactions without any pathogen being identifiable.
And would it be fair to say that people who are afraid and fear of catching something, possibly dying, walking 6 feet apart with mask and everything, that they're under stress or they're...
I'm sure that happens. There was a sociologist who wrote the book about 40 years ago, looking at the death rate according to the unemployment numbers. And he saw that at that time, 40 years ago, the population was quite a bit smaller, but he saw an increase of 35,000 deaths per year for each point of increased unemployment. So a 5-point increase in unemployment would be very, very big, bigger than influenza.
So what I hear you saying is there's a lot more stress other than just the fear of getting something out there, but we have the highest unemployment of unemployed people in this country ever in the history. So that's a whole financial, what am I going to do, stress added on to it.
You hear all sorts of media people saying we have to follow the science,
right?
But they don't want to talk about the science. Two very common phrases you hear, medical experts say, that means one thing, they want you to conform to conventional medical opinion, and medical opinion is regulated by the state, the state boards of medical licensing. If you don't conform too many times, you lose your license. And the other favorite saying is scientists believe. But the thing about science is that it's about testing and descent. And so if you say the descending researchers have been discredited because their opinion is not what medical experts say, then you're denying science itself. Science has to be dissent driven.
There's quite a few Docs on Record YouTube videos, you can find them, that have gone on Dr. Pete and said, well, we're being told to check off corona as cause of death just because, just anybody that we come across, right?
In a typical month, 6 or 7% of all deaths are from respiratory disease like flu or pneumonia. In the last report, they showed what looks like a doubling of respiratory disease associated with the diagnosis of coronavirus. But since respiratory diseases are around 6 or 7% of total mortality, that month should have shown a big increase, not necessarily doubling the 6%, but a definite blip on total mortality. But the CDC, in their most recent report, said total mortality in the U.S. is below average.
Below average?
Yeah. I've been following the CDC's own reports, and not only is nothing happening, but there's a slight dip in total mortality this year. And the only way you can account for that huge spike in corona-diagnosed deaths is to see that it's made up for by a spike downward in deaths from cancer, heart disease, sepsis, and so on. So if you diagnose someone that you would have put down for deaths by sepsis, heart disease, cancer, or other common things, if you decide you're not really sure what killed them, so let's say a coronavirus killed them, then you have a perfectly normal total mortality, but an apparent spike caused by a virus. And with all of the recognized ambiguity and absence of meaning for the definition and the tests, what you have is an epidemic of words.
An epidemic of words. So you say that's what we're experiencing here?
I don't see any.
Any other way?
Yeah.
And it's on record that doctors who say that someone has coronavirus, I believe they receive $9,000 from Medicare, and then if you put them on a ventilator, I think, what is it, $30,000,
$35,000? No, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, the old payment for being admitted with lung infection was around $13,000. But if it's diagnosed as COVID, that gets a 20% boost, so up to about $16,000 for diagnosing a COVID lung disease. But if you put them on a ventilator with ordinary lung disease, that goes up to around $40,000, and a 20% boost takes that up to $48,000. So they're making basically $48,000 for putting someone on a ventilator until they die.
$48,000 received from the hospitals when they put somebody on a ventilator.
Received from both Medicare and the extra bonus from the CARES Act, the Free Money Act.
Oh, good. Dr. Ray Peters with us. Fascinating. What do you know about the dangers of this ventilator? We've read quite a reports. Have you seen some credible information that you can share?
Luciano Gattinoni, an Italian lung specialist working in Germany, has been advocating a more physiological, less dogmatic approach to treating all kinds of pneumonia-like or influenza-like lung infections. And he says in one hospital in Germany, and he didn't want to name either of the hospitals, but one good hospital was having a 60% mortality in their intensive care. And a nearby hospital that was abandoning the standard protocol of intubation had a 0% mortality following his more reasonable and physiological, non-invasive way of ventilating them.
Wow. Interesting.
And if you look at the average figures for mortality, some of the studies show an 88%. That 60% wasn't an outstandingly bad hospital.
Dr. Ray Pete, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. If you care to join the show, 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. It is May 18th. So before we start emails and have our first break, let's talk about vaccine. We're hearing that President Trump is touting that there could be some kind of vaccine by the fall. Just 100 million some kind of devices have been ordered through the military, and I think they want to do some kind of an oral. Do you think it's possible, knowing everything that you have told us about this virus, this alleged virus, I guess is a good term, that there could be some kind of outward substance called a vaccine that could protect people from something that would be safe? I mean, I don't even know how to phrase the question, Dr. Pete.
There's no way to simply state the scientific issue because there has been no actual science involved in it for so long. The media are denying simple on-the-record published facts going back 30, 40 or more years, attempting to make flu vaccines. And they claim, the current CDC claim for effectiveness of a flu, last year's flu vaccine was 45% effective. But if you look at the results they're talking about, it's very weird ways of arguing. They don't simply look at a vaccinated population and an unvaccinated population because there have been about a dozen studies that have considered the whole health of a vaccinated population versus an unvaccinated population. And those have found the people who were vaccinated the next season developed several times as many lung infections from coronaviruses as the unvaccinated. And that has caused sort of a panic in various authoritative sources and fact checkers and so on. But you can look up those studies that the people getting flu vaccines the following year had one study I saw was 4.4 times as many lung diseases caused by coronaviruses and a couple other viruses.
So you're making the argument that a potential for corona vaccine soon to come could be unnecessary and just
dangerous.
Yeah. And would it be dangerous because of the adjuvants, maybe the mercury or aluminum and other things in there, or the substance that they'd be squirting into people, some kind of a virus, small virus?
And if you look at the whole population, the availability of flu vaccines has gone from around 10 million doses per year. 2 years ago, it had a historic high of around 70 million vaccines.
70.
And then last year, again, a huge surge of I think it was 169 million people vaccinated in the U.S. And you'd think if it was 45% effective that this year and last year you would have had a very healthy population. But the curve of influenza, lung disease, pneumonia deaths has been pretty steady over the last 10-15 years. If anything, a rising curve, somewhat following the number of vaccines. So the whole population absolutely doesn't show it a 45% benefit of being vaccinated.
So the scientific proof to show that these flu vaccines are unnecessary and ineffective, but also in many cases are causing more problems the following year.
From different viruses, yeah.
From different viruses, and where are these viruses coming from?
In
the body?
Yeah, in the body and environment. They're just millions of viruses around.
They're just everywhere.
And you can look at the published papers in Nature and Science and the standard virus journals going back. They actually start with germ warfare research, and no one wants to talk about that. For a while, they were saying that the Chinese had a leak of germ warfare viruses, but then that was knocked down. They don't want to talk about it at all. The Fort Detrick and several other labs in the U.S. were created solely for the purpose of germ warfare in the 1940s. Many of our leading medical people were working in germ and chemical warfare. The author of the world's most used medical textbook of physiology, Arthur C. Guyton, was a specialist in aerosolizing germs, bacteria, and viruses. Some of those are known to have been tested on American populations. One of the viruses he was aerosolizing was polio, and he became paralyzed by careless lab work, and so went to Mississippi and became a medical professor and made up out of his head this awful book that became the standard most used medical textbook in the world. Because of his origin and authority coming from government association. And Nixon, in 1969, in response to world pressure, ordered the abolition of the germ warfare program and the destruction of all supplies. And what happened was suddenly the viruses were being made more potent, more virulent as weapons. Suddenly they discovered that there might be someone violating the international rules and making these weapons, and so they kept producing them. They were ordered to stop making weapons, so they said, now these weaponizable viruses have to be made so we can make a vaccine against them. That started right in 1969 when Nixon canceled the war program. And ever since then, they have been designing more and more virulent viruses, and the coronavirus was pretty much their favorite. They did anthrax and Ebola, a lot of other potential weapons, but always with the excuse that we're designing defensive vaccines against these potential weapons, but continuing exactly the gain-of-function type of research, making chimera mixes of different types of virus to escape known immune defenses. But in all of these 40 years of explicitly designing horrible disease-causing viruses so they could make vaccines, they have never succeeded in making a vaccine that worked against them.
Never succeeded in making a vaccine that worked against them.
So why would we expect to have one suddenly, historically, unique event by next fall?
Next fall. Why indeed? Why indeed? Dr. Ray Peet, PhD, what do you think? Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. Quick break. then we're going to get to all of your emails. And we always have lots of them, and we do the best we can. Here's a great product. Previously, with our friend Brandon Amalani of Shen Blossom.
A good example of this also is like the Hoshuwu formula. That is, that's a new one that came out. It's really good because it's a blood builder. A lot of people don't understand that Hoshuwu is actually toxic if it's not prepared correctly. So I wanted to come out with one that not only features the Hoshuwu as the king herb in the formula, but it's prepared of a minimum of 14 days. Usually we try and get 20, 21 days of cooking it. So you can think of it as like it's in a slow cooker with black beans. And it's basically just cooking down and deactivating some of those liver toxic compounds. So we do use that as like the bulk of the formula, but we basically put a lot of like mature ginseng root, like in our root extract. We have the fermented and hydrolyzed pearl powder, reishi stem, and that's got shu di hong, which is like a Romania type family. We got both the prepared warm stuff and then the cool stuff to kind of balance it out in the sense so it doesn't become sticky. If you get a good quality hoshuwu that's properly prepared, it definitely has some invigorating qualities to it and makes you feel relaxed, but yet fully vigorous and energized.
Now, that's the kind of hoshuwu that you would like, right? Really nice products, as you can hear. If you'd like to order hoshuwu or the other products, click on Shen Blossom right there on the front page, oneradionetwork.com. Years ago, I recall David Wolf suggesting that all foods, superfoods, actually just gives our body information. And this came out the last time we talked with Daniel Vitalis about colostrum.
I imagine people being born with an unformatted immune system. And colostrum helps to format that, helps your body recognize viral and bacterial invaders early. And it also helps to restore and heal the lining of the gut that's damaged in so many people and one of the sources of inflammation and low immunity. So it restores that gut lining at the same time that it educates the immune system on how to better fight off pathogens that get into our bodies.
And it's pretty cool too, I think, because moms can put it in the smoothies quite easily for the kids. And it's yummy and they get some good stuff.
Yeah, it's really great to blend into smoothies. You can make chocolates with it. You can put it into anything that you're cooking. And so it's easy to get into your kids and into other family members. It tastes great and it's actually very versatile in the kitchen, so you can use it in place of a lot of other products.
Yes, and it's very tasty and fun and easy to use. Sometimes just late at night, you can take warm water with colostrum in there before bed, and it's a great product, a lot of benefits. Click on any Surthrival link, colostrum, oneradionetwork.com. Yeah, quite a few things on Surthrival on sale right now, just to kind of get you a quick little update here. If you use promo code ROBUST15, they have Taboo, the CBD, and Shizandra Berry, Robust 15 on sale. And then also, let's see, Elk Velvet Antler, and that's on sale as well. And Robust 15. Oh, that's an additional thing. Also, don't forget the D3K2. It's a great product if you'd like to take a little vitamin D3, $29 for a 9-month supply. On any Surthrival link, oneradionetwork.com.
Know the source. One Radio Network.
We're with Dr. Ray Pete. He's a PhD and has been around for a long time doing this kind of research. And so thanks for coming on once a month, Dr. Pete.
Mm-hmm.
Got a lot of fans. Got a lot of fans around the world that listen to the show. So before we move on to some questions, so let's talk about just vaccines. So did this whole germ theory of Pasteur, did it start the vaccine idea?
It somewhat advanced the idea, but I think the real motor for it was Paul Ehrlich and his specific drugs that were designed, silver bullets, the concept of a silver bullet chemical blended in with the idea of antibodies that were the body's silver bullets. And that created, right from Ehrlich's time, the drug companies naturally were pushing their silver bullet chemicals, but that ideologically blended in with the idea that antibodies were silver bullets.
Mm-hmm.
And so the study of the immune system focused all during the last century on the idea that antibodies were the secret to immunity. There were, I guess, about four Nobel Prizes between 1960 and 2000 given for good work on the protein structure of antibodies, but it was misleading because the immune system was being misunderstood because of the emphasis on that particular protein, where really there are a thousand other more important things than antibodies. And the antibody specificity can go either way. It can make a problem worse by intensifying inflammation, as well as take down a potential toxin.
And who was Paul Ehrlich?
Paul Ehrlich, he shared the Nobel Prize of, I think it was 1908, with Metchnikoff, who was an embryologist who emphasized the cell phagocyte part of the immune system rather than the chemical specific silver bullet part. And embryology based picture of the immune system was ridiculed by the chemical cartels all through the 20th century, and two people started proposing a radical alternative for interpreting the immune system that went back to Metchnikoff's recognition that cells and embryological development, the very structure of our being, were part of the immune system. Our whole being is involved in immunity and resistance, all the way from energy, the oxidative energy of each cell, leading to changes in function at all levels. You can't say there's any one thing that is our immune system. So the idea of the immune system has been changing in a kind of underground way. Polly Matzinger works at the NIH now, and she has been changing some of the terms that are now in the mainstream as danger recognition. An English doctor, Jamie Cunliffe, calls it damage recognition system rather than danger. Polly Matzinger is a little closer to the Ehrlich antibody silver bullet by saying that we have a system to recognize danger. But I think Cunliffe is closer to the Metchnikoff interpretation that our whole being is involved, and when we sense damage to our intrinsic nature, that's what we're reacting to, and what they call the immune system, he calls it the disorder repair system, something like that.
Is the entire vaccine phenomena, went back all the way to polio and all that, based on antibodies, and it's still today, even measles, mumps, all these things, based on the antibody idea, which is just a very small part of the immune system.
Yeah.
Why? Dr. Ray Peep, wow. Man. What's a mother to do? Can you imagine moms, what they're being told?
The official story isn't even believed by the insiders.
Really? They don't even believe it.
In December, the chief scientist of the World Health Organization was on international television and telling the public that vaccines have been studied scientifically and they are perfectly safe. And then just 5 days later, someone leaked a video from the Global Summit meeting on vaccine safety. And in that meeting, she was saying that the public is less and less trusting of what we say because of our obfuscation when they ask about the deaths caused by vaccines. One of the main concerns was that doctors were stopping their belief in vaccines, and they weren't vaccinating their children, their own family. She said that that's a real menace if our front line becomes skeptical.
So people like Del Bigtree and Robert Kennedy Jr. conjecture that there's never been a real, authentic, viable test proving that vaccines are safe and effective. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely true. The Congress ordered NIH, or Health and Human Services, to report back to Congress every 2 years at least on studies of safety, because Congress had given absolute immunity to the drug companies to produce vaccines without being sued for the damages. And since there was no financial motive to make them do safety studies, they ordered HHS to do the studies and report every 2 years. And the Bigtree Kennedy lawsuit, when they wouldn't deliver under freedom of information, they wouldn't deliver the documents. Finally, when they were sued, they said no such documents can be found. They simply ignored Congress for 30 years, refusing to do studies because they knew that it was impossible to prove the safety. The tests, all of the data show that certain vaccines are less harmful than others, but some of them are just terribly dangerous. They know that they see the figures, and there's a government agency that under pressure will acknowledge of maybe about 1% of the actual injured patients will get compensation from the government for the deaths and paralysis. But definition that makes it possible to get compensation is that the death or paralysis or whatever has to be recognized and diagnosed within a time limit, 5 days, 15 days. So if you die on the 16th day, you can't be compensated. despite all of that, they have paid out $4 billion to injured patients. But it would be maybe 100 times greater if they didn't have those time limits. And the government lists the injuries that they are bound to compensate for. And that list of injuries that they are compensating with fairly paltry amounts of money, it coincides with the package insert label, the list of side effects published by the pharmaceutical companies, matches the conditions that the government is paying for. So if the doctor insert for the vaccine, if the patient knew that death and paralysis and brain damage and dementia, etc., were known, recognized side effects, how many people would let their kids be vaccinated?
Fascinating. So there is, I wonder, wasn't that in 1986? Was that the immunity law during Reagan or 86?
That was when the immunity was given to the drug industry.
So I wonder why there's even that many billions given out kind of under the table.
Well, it's some little recognition of justice, but meanwhile they're doing their best to not let people know that there is that system even. Most doctors haven't heard of that system of compensations. Most doctors don't read the package inserts, and so they keep giving vaccines.
Dr. Ray Peet, PhD, Patrick Timpone, it's OneRadioNetwork.com. You can check out his website, raypeet.com, and we always have a link, and it'll take you right to Dr. Peet, and you can get his newsletter. Comes out every couple of months. So, well, it's been really interesting talking about this. Let's dig in, if you will, sir, to a few of the emails in the time we have remaining. We always have so many for you. This is from Thomas. He says, I finally took the dive and managed to get my hands on some desiccated thyroid out of Thailand. I do feel better after a couple of months of slowly upping the dose. I'm just wondering what Mr. Peet thinks about the best way to dose throughout the day. I always take it first thing in the morning and then a second time around noon or a few hours later. Is taking it twice and better than just doing it once a day or on an empty stomach? Any ideas? I would appreciate it.
With desiccated thyroid, it really doesn't make very much difference because it has no hormone action until it's been digested. And so if you eat it with food, it's going to slowly release the hormone all during the passage of that food through your small intestine. And it's ideally twice a day, theoretically, it could be better, but in practice, once a day is fine with desiccated thyroid.
Uh-huh. So is that still, folks are going to do some of the piggy thyroid, that's still the best to get a desiccated thyroid where you have the T3, T4, and all that right in there?
I think so. It has a lot of other things that are plausible benefits. For example, the American brands, when the armor company sold their product name, the new companies started removing components such as calcitonin to sell separately. That was always part of the traditional thyroid. And so the stuff from Thailand is more likely to be the full natural material coming out of the animal. And so it could be more beneficial than a selected purified material. But even the synthetics that imitate that balance of T4 and T3, those are almost always completely therapeutic.
Is there a way to use either one of the Thailand or the synthetic to work with your thyroid to get it happy again so you can get off of them? Or
The traditional method that developed over several decades of practical use was to start with about 30 milligrams for a month, watching for its effects. And Broda Barnes found that the temperature when you wake up is a good way to watch the daily progression of a given dose. And then after maybe 6 or 8 weeks, if the symptoms weren't gone, you would double the dose. And over a period of 5 or 6 months, usually you would settle in for most people around 120 milligrams or 2 grains.
But once you're on there, are you there forever, or?
No, in fact, I tested on myself after reading experiments on rats, and I found that my requirement in winter months was about 2 grains a day. But in the spring, I became slightly hyperthyroid on that dose and found that my summer dose was around half a grain.
Half a grain is 30 milligrams, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you say symptoms, were you going by your temperature, or you could just feel, is a general observation, you get a little just antsy with too much?
I went mostly by my pulse rate, but if I didn't drop the dose in the spring, I would start getting out of breath just getting up to answer the telephone.
No kidding.
Which is a sign of hyperthyroidism.
Oh, hyper. Yeah, that'd be a sign of hyper. Here is Thea. She wants to know, how can I get the most benefit of using progesterone properly? If using Progest-E daily, rubbing on gums, is it still beneficial to skip maybe 7 to 14 days a month, or is that only if ingesting it?
And
would it be the same for a male, she is also asking.
The liver, the reason a woman cycles 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off is partly that the liver is designed so that it maintains homeostasis, meaning that when something rises above average, it increases its excretory enzymes, makes it leave the body in the bile and urine. And so when you have this big surge after ovulation of progesterone, it's extremely effective the first week, and then as the liver increases its enzymes, its effectiveness drops off gradually. And if you get pregnant, then the signals keep increasing so that your progesterone production rises steadily until the last week of pregnancy, and the liver never gets ahead to lower this huge production of progesterone, always keeps your serum level ahead of your liver. But if you're not pregnant and keep taking without interruption, then your liver starts becoming so efficient that after 2 or 3 months, you can hardly feel the effect of the same dose of progesterone. So just to keep for economy, so that you're sensitive to moderate doses, it's good to lay off for a week or two every month.
Here's an email from Dustin. He's in Nashville, Tennessee this morning. He says, beyond regular proper dosages of thyroid, progesterone, pregnenolone, and obviously a good PUFA-free diet, what would Dr. Pete recommend as the best regimen for retaining the elasticity and the healing of scars, especially those past 50, and looking my best.
One of the factors that creates stiffness and specific loss of structural elasticity, but combined with stiffness, so basically it's a brittleizing effect of stress. The system that drives that is mainly it involves estrogen and cortisol, but the central factor is the angiotensin or renin angiotensin aldosterone system. Aldosterone is the opposing hormone to progesterone, the natural level of progesterone is one of the things that keeps your tissue firm, proper bulk, and elastic. Simply the absence of progesterone or excess of estrogen will turn on this angiotensin aldosterone system and tend to weaken tissue so that you are more susceptible to aneurysms, bulging arteries, varicose veins, general weakening. Tissues become easier to break from a scuff. You can get more serious injury from light percussion and such. Strengthening part is partly opposing those, keeping them down, and the things that most strongly keep down your aldosterone system are vitamin D, zinc, all of the growth protein anabolic things such as vitamin A, balance of calcium and phosphate. Calcium works with vitamin D to hold down your aldosterone, which is the major brittleizing hormone.
Brittleizing hormone. Hey. So are there any foods that keep the progesterone level nice and the aldosterone down, dietary wise?
Eggs and zinc and milk.
Eggs and zinc and milk.
For example, stretch marks. I had a young cousin who was about 6 months pregnant, and she showed me her belly had these purple lightning streak patterns. Half an inch wide and brilliant color with a zigzag, shiny pattern, and it was just the most vivid stretch marks I'd ever seen, I suggested eggs, milk, and oysters. Which she ate for 2 or 3 days. I think it was just about 3 days later she came back and showed me her belly. No marks at all.
Isn't that interesting?
It was just amazing how they had... her belly was meanwhile getting bigger, but the stretch marks had absolutely disappeared.
Fascinating. Isn't oysters also been touted to help men keep testosterone levels up? Oysters?
Sure. That's part of keeping cortisol and aldosterone down.
I see. Oh, it tamps them down so the T levels can stay good. Here is Matthew. My question for Dr. Pete: can aspirin be taken together with Losartan? How do you say that?
Losartan.
I'm currently on 50 milligrams of Losartan. I want to know how much aspirin I can take.
There have been a lot of publications on that, warning against the aspirin, but I think the conclusion is, they're perfectly compatible.
Mm-hmm. And why would we want to take aspirin? Is it okay?
For example, for the coronavirus, those happen to be both confirmed effective protections against the symptoms of the corona infection.
Good old aspirin. Can you actually get just pure aspirin these days, or they all have extracurricular activities in them?
No, the cheap kind is generally the best. It's called aspirin USP, and it doesn't matter whether it's sold by a veterinary supply store. It's about $15 per pound.
A pound. Can Dr. Pete elaborate on the mechanism of action of adaptogenic herbs, or are they estrogenic? Is it safe to use, example, ginseng or Korean ginseng?
A lot of studies found that there are steroids analogous to, but not exactly the same as testosterone and pregnenolone, the stabilizing steroids that protect against cortisol. But I think it's safer to use pregnenolone if you can find a safe and pure form.
Pregnenolone. Oh, more emails here. Got lots of them. Let's see. Patrick Timpone, along with Dr. Ray Pete. Sorry, my little mouse is not cooperating. Oh, here you go. Okay. What does it mean from Stefan? What does it mean when a woman bleeds during ovulation? Is it a progesterone issue?
To some extent, the surge of estrogen, its effect is to break down the lining of the uterus, and that's opposed by progesterone. So usually the people who have the what they call breakthrough bleeding, it can come any time. For example, after a woman gets pregnant, if she was having those ovulation bleeds, she's likely to have a monthly loss of blood, even into the fifth month of pregnancy. And that goes with all of the signs of progesterone deficiency, preeclampsia or premature birth or all kinds of complications of pregnancy resulting from the bad balance of progesterone and estrogen.
Uh-huh. One of your specialties, right?
Yeah.
Been studying that a long time. Julie wants to know what you think, Doc, about intermittent fasting and a ketogenic diet for reversing type 2 diabetes.
I think the so-called ketogenic diet is always stressful. Diabetes itself tends to turn on the stress ketogenic factors. The body senses a lack of glucose in diabetes, and that turns on stress metabolism, and lactic acid tends to rise, showing that glucose is actually being used, although the body feels that it is deficient in glucose, so it starts turning muscles to glucose, and that happens in the ketogenic diet. The cortisol increases when glucose is low, and the cortisol converts muscle to glucose at the same time that you're drawing fats out of storage or eating fats, still the fact that your diet is ketogenic means that your cortisol is bound to be having too much influence. And that is one of the things that shrinks your thymus and other parts of your so-called immune system.
Could you please ask Dr. Pete to talk more about pregnenolone? Can it be used to reduce estrogen dominance in the body? Is there any change that pregnenolone would be converted to estrogen instead of progesterone and testosterone?
The quantity of a hormone that is powerfully active in rat experiments and in experiments I did on myself with the rats, they gave, I think it was 10 grams of pregnenolone in a single dose, enough to stretch its stomach so it couldn't eat anything for hours. But they didn't see any hormonal effects in most of the rats. But if the rat was stressed and having high glucocorticoid before the pregnenolone, they were normalized. So the only change was beneficial stopping of the stress reaction. And I found that 4,000 milligrams a day didn't have any harmful effect. Was felt about the same as 100 milligrams a day.
Ah, okay. Here's somebody else. Go ahead.
As in the rats, its effect when you have a slight excess of pregnenolone is to lower your cortisol to normal, and an elevated cortisol is one of the things that increases estrogen. And so when you're blocking the stress reaction with an abundance of pregnenolone, you're turning off the need for these other stress hormones. And where the body will make, a human body will make on the order of 30 to 50 milligrams a day of pregnenolone and progesterone, and 5 milligrams of testosterone, and probably around 50 milligrams of DHEA. The daily dose produced in the body of estrogen is on the order of a small fraction of a microgram. One microgram per day is an effective estrogenic dose. So quantity of these precursor hormones, if they're adequate, they tend to turn off these microscopic downstream hormones. So you will never have an increased conversion to estrogen or cortisol from an excess of pregnenolone or progesterone.
Okay. Dr. Ray P. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. So much is talked about oxidation and this cool thing with this new technology that we're working on. And we have a 20% deal on this machine, too, if you're interested. Previously, with the highly credentialed Dr. Thomas Levy, he argues because the literature shows that oxidation is the cause of disease.
But the whole point is the location, the concentration, the duration, the distribution of oxidized biomolecules determines 100% of all diseases. And so that's why I say oxidative stress doesn't cause disease. Oxidation is disease.
Is disease.
If there's no oxidized biomolecules, you don't have a toxin. The toxic effect is oxidation of biomolecules. That's the entirety of it.
And by the grace of God, several months ago, George Wiseman said this about hydrogen.
Hydrogen is the world's best antioxidant by a long shot.
Hmm.
First of all, it's 700 times smaller than something like CoQ10, 400 times smaller than vitamin C, things like that. So it can literally go, the hydrogen molecule can literally go through everything in your body and go right into the very DNA and repair it.
So now it makes sense why George was able to say this back in August 2019 with such conviction.
The body accepts that gas and uses it to heal everything. It's like the fountain of youth. It's astonishing the amount of ailments. In fact, in scientific studies, and they have over 1,000 scientific studies now, they are showing that it either helps the body heal directly or indirectly from virtually every ailment that ails any water-based life form.
Okay, I'm sold. And I was able to get one a couple of months ago, thanks to your support. It's called the AquaCure Hydrogen Machine. Breathe the gas and bubble the water. There's a promo code ONERADIO for 10% discount.
Well, let's just stop right there and tell you it's 20%. George sprung that on us last week. A 20% deal for another 7 days or so, and that's it. So if you've been thinking about getting one, it's a lifetime warranty, so it'll be a lifetime investment. 1 year, no questions asked, money back warranty, and very interesting technology. This machine produces Brown's gas as well as molecular hydrogen. You can go to the molecularhydrogeninstitute.com, or is it .org? One of those, you'll see it. Google it up and look on studies, and you'll see hundreds and hundreds of studies, peer-reviewed studies on the benefits of Brown's gas and hydrogen. And it all involves oxidation. Almost every one of these studies, they talk about oxidation. So there's something real here. You can use this for your lifetime. And who knows what kind of good things can go on. 20% promo code ONERADIO for the next week. Promo code ONERADIO, 20% discount. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Know the source. One Radio Network. Know the source.
The source.
OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, we're honored to have Dr. Ray Pete, PhD, on our show. And he's here the second or third, it'll be the third Monday of each month at 10:30 Central Time. More things. This one here, I wanted to see if I can. This is Lindsay. Did I lose Lindsay? She had a thing about she's going to have babies, and she's going to have baby in. Oh, here she is. She's going to have babies in 2 years or so. Wants to know how she can balance things out with her progesterone, regulate progesterone hormone for better health and prepare for a child in a couple of years. And she is also, another one, bleeding during ovulation.
The thyroid is most often the problem hormone in causing pregnancy problems. So you want to check your temperature and pulse rate, and maybe have a blood test to make sure that your TSH level isn't elevated. The TSH itself is really a sign of some problem. So the higher it is, the less likely you are to have a successful pregnancy. There have been several publications that are showing a direct link between increased TSH, even within the so-called normal range, and pregnancy problems. And part of keeping that normal is to have adequate protein every day, not too much phosphate. Meat and beans and nuts happen to be extremely high in phosphate relative to calcium. The high phosphate turns on your parathyroid hormone and the aldosterone, so it's bad for all of your tissues and it increases cancer risk and so on. Calcium should be high relative to the phosphate and vitamin D and calcium work together. Adequate vitamin A works with the thyroid hormone to have an anabolic effect on your proteiny tissues, the thymus gland, among others, keeping your muscles well developed as part of keeping your endocrine system in balance.
Interesting. So, one enough protein, but the meat, beans, and what else?
Meat, beans, and fish.
Fish have a high phosphate, which is a little counterintuitive there.
The phosphate, it just happens that those are very low in calcium content. The foods that are highest have the best ratio of calcium to phosphate are cheese, milk, for an extreme high calcium ratio, well-cooked greens are the richest in calcium and magnesium relative to phosphate.
Mm-hmm. So when the phosphate gets too high with the beans, fish, and meat, that's a problem for almost everybody, right, if you have too much of those.
Americans in general. When you look at the figures, the higher the phosphate is, when it gets to be 5, 6, or 7 times as high as the calcium, that leads to long-term problems like osteoporosis and inflammatory diseases.
Hmm. On the TSH, you had mentioned the normal levels. We can't go by those, but what would be a good TSH level after all these years of talking about thyroid that would say, well, everything's pretty good there with the thyroid? What level would that be?
When people have done large-scale surveys and looked at the incidence of thyroid cancer over the years, they have found that if your TSH is below 0.4, there's no thyroid cancer.
0.4? Well, that's a low one, man.
Right? Yeah.
That's really way down there. So would you keep taking, if you wanted to test, just to be real geeky about it, Dr. Pete, would you keep testing if you're taking some kind of a piggy thyroid desiccated to get that down that low?
I think it would be worthwhile. I go entirely by my pulse and temperature.
Your pulse,
But when I see people's results, if their TSH is as high as even 1.0, they always have some hormone-related problem. Two is where everyone I see with a 2.0, they have fairly significant hormone problems by the time they're in their 30s.
My goodness. Stefan wants to know, would there be any benefits to introducing sourdough starter to the dough for making flour tortillas?
I don't know how a sourdough flour tortilla would turn out. It might be you lose gluten with the starter, I think it might be hard to make something resembling a tortilla. But anyway, flour tortillas are essentially unleavened wheat, and studies have shown, for example, in Egypt, they have seen dwarfism associated with people eating a lot of unleavened wheat bread.
I got some of that Nixtamize, the one you talked about from that company, the grits, right? The corn grits. And is there any protein in corn?
A little, no, yeah.
Not too much?
Not very much.
But is it pretty good food in general?
As long as they get some protein and other nutrients. You can't live on tortillas and beans healthfully, but people who eat nixtamalized tortillas as regular part of their diet are usually very healthy if they have mixed other foods with it, mm-hmm. partly because of the high calcium content.
High calcium. So they are the milk, cheese, greens. How about eggs?
Not very good. They're somewhat excessive for phosphate. But of course, the protein and seafood, you're getting the trace minerals. So it's good to have seafood once a week and mm-hmm. eggs every day. And the nixtamalized corn is another source of calcium in the diet.
Yeah. So this is Nessa, and I'll try to see if I can get through this. It's kind of long, and let's see if I can edit it down a little bit, if you can keep your emails as short as possible. She had TSH 9.7, put her on Armour, 30 milligrams. After 7 weeks, went down 1.93. Her doc changed her to Levoxer thyroxine, level, however you say that, 5 milligrams. Been reading the Rhoda Barnes book, and she asked her doctor to change her back to Armour instead of the 30 and to 60. She suggested I would be able to convert the T4 to T3 as needed. And would you agree with this? I do have MS, and it seems the Armour was helping me with morning muscle spasms that I was experiencing.
What was her TSH when she...
1.93 after being on the Armour 30 milligrams for 7 weeks.
I think it should still be lower, but that's a tremendous improvement.
Yeah.
I would guess that the having a chronic TSH as high as 9.0 would be a major factor in what was diagnosed as MS.
Sure. Wow.
And that one of the things that you almost always see with a good thyroid correction is the muscle cramps. The first few days while you're adjusting, you need to make sure your diet is very high in calcium and magnesium. So a lot of milk while you're adapting to increasing thyroid dose will prevent muscle cramps. But basically, thyroid is one of the nerve muscle protecting hormones, absolutely essential.
Beth wants to know from Dr. Ray Pete, do you think the 5G or glyphosates have anything to do with this whole coronavirus thing?
Oh, sure. Each of them is known to be biologically harmful, and our whole system is part of our resistance and immunity. And so if you do anything crazy like sit in an electromagnetic field mm-hmm. of any measurable intensity, even running an electric sewing machine for 20 years, they found a tremendous increase in dementia.
Really?
Associated with just that moderate field. But the fields from these communication devices can be many times more intense.
Very challenging. So anything with a motor, really, we get some magnetic fields, don't we? Anything with a
mm-hmm.
motor, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dr. Pete, do you know, this is great, how much thyroid medication one can get out of one slaughtered pig?
Oh, the gland is about as big as a human gland in proportion, maybe an ounce or so. And the measuring in grains or grams, the standard pill was based on the fresh gland because for the first 10 or 20 years, they prescribed the uncooked gland. They would give usually 4 grains or 250 milligrams roughly as a replacement dose. And so when they started making dehydrated tablets, they added usually lactose to extend the powdered gland, which they call 3X, as a pure powder, and then they would dilute it, increasing the weight by threefold, so that 1X was the potency of the finished pill, which was equivalent in weight to the natural wet thyroid tissue. And so if you think of a 30-gram gland, each gram contains about 15 grains. So you can get 120 doses of more or less replacement dose from a single gland.
Do you think when people ate more of a natural, I guess on the farm and stuff, that or chickens, that we used to get some kind of the thyroid in there, didn't we, with the chickens?
I used to find, even at the Safeway supermarket, a pound of chicken necks, two or three of them, they would have left the gland, thyroid gland, under the skin, even though it was illegal. Starting in the 1940s, the government required that it be removed and sold to the drug companies. On the farm, they would almost never bother removing the gland, so it goes in the soup or fried chicken. A guy I knew who worked on a farm said on Fridays, that was their fried chicken day. And he always asked for the necks and would eat four or five necks for lunch. And he said he'd always noticed that on Friday afternoons, he was constantly overheated and sweating because he was eating like 15 grains of thyroid for lunch.
Isn't that interesting? Wow. Yeah, you would think if you ate a live thyroid that you'd feel that, wouldn't you? I mean, if you just, ate a whole one or something like that.
They aren't as toxic as the government warned. If that guy was on average, if half of the neck still had the gland in it, each one might weigh 1 gram. That would be 30 grains for lunch. And a friend of mine had her thyroid powder in a plastic bag, and her cat, she had about 30 grains of thyroid in the bag, and her cat found it and tore the bag open and ate it all.
Really?
And she said he was sitting there with a very fast heartbeat, smiling.
Smiling. Hey, guys, great show. Patrick, could you please ask Dr. Pete, what does he think of yogurt? Yogurt.
If it's standard, tangy, somewhat sour yogurt, that amount of lactic acid in a big cup full is enough to cause the liver reaction. The liver turns it back to glucose, but it's energetically expensive to turn lactic acid into glucose. And someone who is slightly hypothyroid can notice the depressed energy or even a headache brought on by as little as a cup of yogurt.
Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about mebendazole for parasites? There's somebody that's taken the dose and just wants to know if you think it's relatively safe.
If you're sure you have a dangerous parasite, yeah, it's better than the parasite. But if you are not certain there's a parasite, its toxicity is enough. It isn't something to take diagnostically.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause he says he has bruxism, severely grounding of my teeth. Is that one symptom of parasites?
That goes with sometimes anything irritating the intestine, but often it's your green salad that you ate at lunch is a more common cause of intestinal irritation during the night, because that releases serotonin into the system, and high serotonin is strongly associated with bruxism.
High serotonin.
So you might try something like cyproheptadine to see what effect that is at bedtime.
What's cyproheptadine? What is that?
It's an antihistamine, anti-serotonin, old-fashioned antihistamine with the anti-serotonin function.
Is that a pharmaceutical med?
It's a prescription drug, I think. But a lot of doctors are willing to prescribe it.
So raw veggies can cause high serotonin?
The cellulose in uncooked vegetables especially is indigestible, and so that carries the food far down your intestine where bacteria can get at it, and the bacteria live on cellulose-rich foods and produce toxins, and the irritation of the chemicals from the food and the bacteria and their toxins cause the intestine to pour out a flood of histamine and serotonin, and it's known that bruxism is very closely connected with high serotonin.
Do you think one has the same challenges with like sunflower sprouts or radish sprouts?
If they're cooked or if you grind up alfalfa sprouts while they're raw, there's a surge of cyanide release, so you don't want to eat a mass of raw cyanide, raw sprouts of alfalfa.
How about sunflower, radish sprouts?
I think those are safer, except for the high anti-thyroid effect.
Oh, they kind of could tamper down the thyroid, huh?
The radish sprouts in particular.
Oh, well, that's right, yeah. Well, Dr. P, we're out of time, and if we didn't get your email, we'll just put it in our file here, and we'll get you next time around. So no telling where this whole corona thing will be. 30 days from now, lots of talk about a second wave. Do you have any theories on that?
Same issue.
Yeah.
The word epidemic, if they're putting down sepsis, heart disease, and cancer as coronavirus deaths, then you have to look at the state of the language at the moment.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Proof's in the pudding, and the God's in the details. Dr. Pete, we appreciate so much your being here. Thanks for your time, and we'll see you next time around, okay?
Oh, okay, thanks.
Thank you. Dr. Ray Pete, Patrick Timpone, and OneRadioNetwork.com. We have a little link there that you can click on at the show page, and you can get the Dr. Ray Pete's newsletter. I think it's we'll give you the email. You just email there, and then you're ready to go. Okay, so thanks for the shows, for being here with Dr. Massey and Dr. Pete. David Wolf, yep, cool guy, really good man. He'll be here in the morning, 9 o'clock Central Time. If you have a question for probably one of the foremost, I guess, most popular and experienced raw food vegan guys, but he stretched out his wings a bit and tried different kinds of foods over the years, just like a lot of them. So we'll talk to him about all kinds of things with David Wolf. That'll be tomorrow, 9 o'clock Central Time. Thanks for your ongoing support. Remember that I love you all very much, and I appreciate you being here. If there's anything I can do for you, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. patrick@oneradionetwork.com. We'll see you in the morning with David Wolf. I love you, and may the blessings be.
We are listener-supported. One Radio Network.